Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, zombie load means you need to patch your Intel CPU again. Gorgeous folding ThinkPad laptops coming from Lenovo. HP's got a dual-screen gaming laptop. SanDisk ships 1 TB micro SD cards and quite a bit more, all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 517, recorded on May 16th, 2019. Time to patch your Intel CPU again. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, a Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you surprise hardware news, CPUs, GPUs, laptops, desktops, mobile consoles, the Internet of Stuff. We're here for you, people. I'm Patrick Norton, joined by Mr. Sebastian Peake of PCPer.com. Sebastian, are you excited about the new Zombie Load movie?
Yeah, I mean, it's been 9 years. We were discussing, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary. It's very popular, and I just can't wait to see a surprise appearance by Bill Murray again.
Bill Murray as the attack. Man, you guys did a nice write-up on this. If you haven't heard of this, zombieloadattack.com is the website. Both Sebastian and I have had difficulty with spell correct turning Zombie Load into Zombie Land, the fantastic 2009 movie, which involves zombies and Woody Harrelson and Emma Stone and lots of other people. There's essentially a new data sampling flaw. You know, patches have been released. It was found by security researchers. It's not in the wild. The fixes that were completed before the disclosure was made. But essentially, if you can't get access to execute this, in theory, they could grab information from the core of the processor to kind of grossly oversimplify on that one. They called it like Cyberus Technology calls it a cross privilege boundary data leakage. And I'm going to quote their post on the Zombie Load. By exploiting the CPU's so-called bypass logic on return values of loads, it is possible to leak data across processes, privilege boundaries, hyperthreads, as well as values that are loaded inside Intel SGX enclaves and between VMs. That's a big delete expletive deal, because all that stuff is supposed to be fairly well sandboxed from each other's. This is not software. It's a hardware issue. It is operating system independence. Quote, it is possible to retrieve content that is currently being used by a hyperthread sibling. It's messy. It is kind of a distant cousin to what we saw with Spectre last year. It's unfortunate. There is a patch. There was some initial... there will be a performance hit. The stuff I've seen says mostly 3 to 9%, but that of course seems to be quoting kind of the patch running on the fastest processors Intel's ever made. I have seen titles, but I have not seen supporting evidence where some people think it could be as much as of a dramatic a hit as 40%. A lot of that I think depends on the application. A lot of places are recommending you turn hyper-threading off, which I think is probably overkill for most people. I mean, how are you? I mean, are you pissed off? I had some friends who just on an email thread, many of whom run what I will affectionately call large server farm type environments, who apparently just went out and started kicking tree stumps and fire hydrants and stuff. They were so pissed off when this was announced. How are you feeling about this so far, Sebastian?
I would say a little bit different. When I first heard about it, it was, here we go again, but also the initial instructions about mitigating the vulnerability was disable hyper-threading. And this was very, very big. That's where that 40% comes from. And that was Jim, our managing editor, he uses a Mac as his primary computer, and he was looking into like the Mac side of things, and the Apple quote that he has is, The full mitigation, which includes disabling hyperthreading, prevents information leakage across threads, and et cetera, et cetera. So they leave it up to Mac users whether they're actually going to disable hyperthreading or not. But there are instructions. You actually have to go into the terminal and you put in an argument and restart the computer to disable or re-enable hyperthreading. It's not easy. But if you're thinking about even a recent iMac with, say, a 7th generation Core i7 processor in it, you paid for the i7 upgrade, and then literally you take away hyperthreading and you've got yourself a Core i5.
Right.
So that's huge. Apparently, I mean, like you said, it's kind of workload dependent. Intel is saying that you do not specifically have to disable hyperthreading. It really depends on what you're doing and the level of security that you need. But the only way to truly ensure security, apparently, does involve disabling hyperthreading. So it's kind of the same thing we heard about before, because this is all speculative. What am I thinking of? Speculative execution, and just the way that these processors got so fast over the last decade and a half or so is basically doing a lot of guessing, very fast, intelligent guessing, a lot of stuff in microcode. And there are patches that were issued. This was one of those things where they actually held back. The researchers contacted Microsoft and Intel and Apple and Google were all working behind the scenes so that when this website went live and when they came forward with their findings, there were already patches being distributed. So once again, like single digit performance decreases noted, but then it's a matter of whether or not you feel like you need to, or whether or not you have to, depending on, you know, the policies, like where you work, what type of work the computer is doing. Just home users are probably fine just running the latest updates. There were some things that were patched in browsers, like JavaScript exploits, and then of course OS level patching. And I would imagine this will get better maybe with the maturation of some of these mitigations. And of course, certain processors are already protected in hardware. I know you linked to the document that Intel distributed. It's this huge PDF file of all the processors. And there's only select processors in 8th and 9th gen that are immune to this, or have rather hardware workarounds. Right. And then the rest have to use software, which of course slows things down. So the next generation of Intel parts will be the first generation that's across the board going to have hardware mitigations, is what I'm reading into this.
Yeah, it's a long, you know, it's the microcode revision guidance, if you're watching the video, is what you're looking at right now. And section one is the planned microcode updates. And it is a staggeringly long list of processors, as you would expect, right? Because, you know, they pretty much said this is going back to like 2011. You know, I'm looking at Haswell, Ivy Bridge, Kaby Lake, Sandy Bridge. It just goes on and on and on. You know, this is one of those things where I'm glad the researchers found it. I'm curious, you know, from a purely kind of security through obscurity, which is generally a bad idea. I'm curious whether or not anybody would have ever found this, or if, you know, by some wild chance somebody had already in the past, which I doubt. But expect an update, you know, for your desktop or your laptop. Check your motherboard, check your website for your laptop. You know, if you run servers, you know what to do better than we do. But yeah, zombieloadattack.com for more information. And, you know, we're going to try to pick the news up and get a little more cheerful at this point. You guys had a post AMD's Horizon Gaming event. It'll be live streaming from E3 2019, June 10th, 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Not that I'm kind of stupid excited. This is, what's the word? What do we expect to be announced at this one?
Well, we can start by picking the screenshot of the video apart and talk about how the Z in Horizon is suspiciously highlighted where it would look like a 7. And so, of course, I mean, they've been doing the whole 7 nanometer thing for a while, and Radeon 7 is already a thing. So because it's a gaming event, we assume this is Navi or Navi, the graphics card launch. And right. Dr. Su, the CEO of AMD, is giving the keynote at Computex. So I would hope that on stage at Computex, she's revealing the specs and all the final details about Ryzen 3000 series processors is my hope. The only one of these announcements, looking through their actual PR page, that promised hardware announcements was E3. But another processor roadmap was, I don't know if it came about because of an earnings call or what, but there was one being distributed around, I think, yesterday, the day before, that said that basically they've confirmed yet again, as if we needed any further confirmation, of what's coming this year. So it's literally just a matter of whether we get it at the end of May or into the second week of June. And this, the video cards, in theory, being available by Q3 is what we keep on seeing. Like, and there have been fewer rumors surrounding Navi than Ryzen, as far as I've seen.
Right.
But so I don't know anything. I've not seen even any credible, you know, spec sheets saying, like, this is how many, you know, streaming processors it's going to have. Here's a core count or the clock speeds. So we will see. But it's been a long time coming. We've been teased about new products since CES, and we've heard rumors even before then. So it'll be a refreshing change to have into the summer brand new, you know, Zen 2 CPUs, brand new GPUs that are hopefully put some pressure on NVIDIA, and we see prices start to fall across the industry. So it can only be a good thing for all parties.
We hope.
Or mostly the consumer. You know, I don't care if NVIDIA has to lower their prices. That's fine. Or an AMD too. Just cheaper things, faster, and, you know, more physical cores and less hyper-threading too.
We wait.
Sorry.
With bated breath.
No. I get it.
We're supposed to be positive.
Bigger, better, faster, more. I actually got hands-on with this a few weeks ago. Lenovo has a ThinkPad prototype, not going to see it before 2020, that is completely foldable. And it was really interesting to play around with this because it is a big folding screen that happens to be a laptop, you know, like a 13.3-inch 2K OLED, 4:3 aspect ratio. Got to type on it. You know, it becomes a 16:9, 9.6-inch screen when you fold it up. They are not super detailed at this point. This was a very early reveal of a prototype. And I can flat out say, A, it worked. B, it worked really, really well. C, I got to play around with an external keyboard device that would, you know, sort of fit in there. LG's making the display. pretty simple. USB-C ports, stereo speakers, Wacom-based pen supports. You know, it's going to ship with a Bluetooth keyboard. And, they were adamant that it would have an all-day battery. And it's thick enough behind both of those screens where it folds that it has the space to put a whole bunch of battery in there, which you'll need for a screen that big to have all-day power. I think it's really, really interesting to look at. I may also be just kind of fascinated by the idea of having a large display that folds into a small display. The hinge looks really sophisticated. Because as we've seen with certain phones, you actually have to be able to radius the OLED, the foldable OLED, to keep a particular radius on the foldable OLED to keep from damaging it. And then, of course, you know, you kind of try to tension it out a little bit. And I talked to them about that because you can't really, these screens don't stretch. So tensioning is probably not the right word, but it was interesting. The screen looked gorgeous and we don't expect to see it much before 2020. Well, we won't see it period before 2020. But foldable ThinkPad X1, it's been in development for several years now. And I think it's interesting. I'm very curious to get my grubby little paws on one of these when it becomes a real product.
We've seen dual screen prototypes in the past, and then there's shipping products. The YogaBook C930 is a shipping product that has two, like a, it's like more like a digitizer, like a Wacom, Wacom or Wacom? I need a ruling.
Let's call it Wacom.
Wacom, okay. It has one of those, which of course can become a keyboard or a writing pad. And I think that was the one where you could put a sheet of paper over the bottom half and draw, and it would like pick up what you were doing. And it's that it's an interesting concept. I remember the first time I saw one of those, I think it was at CES 2016, like behind closed doors, like looking at the first prototype, which I became one of these products. But yeah, the I hope obviously that it's more successful than Samsung's first attempt. It's a better form factor. Coming out with folding screen electronics that you're going to come in and out of your pocket all day long and constantly be open and closed, maybe not the best place. People generally work at their laptop for, you know, some period of time longer than just glancing at a phone. So, and they make pretty durable stuff. And it was actually while you were talking, I was thinking, you know, it's not IBM anymore, but the ThinkPad brand has been associated with some pretty interesting, innovative things in the laptop space. I absolutely fell in love with Lenovo's ThinkPad Yoga, the first one, the S1. I think it's like 2013, 2014. And that has the lift and lock keyboard. It's a two-in-one, but as you fold the screen around, the keys rise up and then lock into place. So as you're holding it, you don't feel yourself pressing keys in. And it had a much more solid feel. Just like watching it, like this mechanism rise up is all a physical mechanism. It reminds me of IBM's ThinkPad 701C, which I was reminded of from an LGR video last year. But that was the laptop with the butterfly keyboard. As you lifted the laptop lid, the keyboard rose and then expanded into a wide keyboard. But it all fit down into like this sub 12-inch class notebook. So they've historically done some really interesting things, whether it's Lenovo or IBM. So to me, it just makes sense. Like, have them innovate, come out with this unique form factor. I think it was the Yoga that sort of drove the 360 hinge. You saw so many things after the initial Yoga laptop came out with a very similar, you know, completely, you know, almost like a watch style hinge instead of some of the things that the industry was trying to do before, like lift and twist the entire display. And just some oddities that we saw. So
it's certainly, I mean, yeah, there've been some really awkward ways of solving the how do we rotate the panel. Most of the awkward ones have fallen by the wayside in favor of giant hinges, simply because it's less painful to fold the book over than it is to do any of a number of odd moves. By the way, I've double checked. Wacom is pronounced Wacom, and is derived from the Japanese symbol for harmony, wa, and the first syllable of computer, kum. The tag of the company is toward the harmonious development between man and technology, which is a lot of information I never knew about Wacom before.
Wacom. Okay, got it. I was going to ask, though, about that laptop design. Obviously, the tastes are going to vary, and I don't know how they're implementing it, but if you have that open, you're going to be dealing with a virtual keyboard, which is fine. We've been trained for the last decade. Okay. I was just wondering if they were implementing some sort of haptic feedback as you typed on the lower screen to make it feel like you were actually pressing something down,
or what they were doing. It was a little early for haptic feedback on what I tested. I think we'll find out much, 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 much closer to when it ships.
Okay. I want all the details now, Patrick.
Of course you do. But it's not finished yet, you see. That makes it very awkward to promise what will be inside of it. I mean,
promise anything. I could promise you the earth right now. I'm just not going to deliver. I think we both know that.
And Sebastian broke my heart yet again. we were talking about computers and technology. You were looking at Gordon Ma-Ung over at PC World. I got hands-on with HP's Omen X 2S15, quote, the world's first dual-screen gaming laptop. And I'm trying to decide if it's really dual-screen, and it is, but it's not in the way you're thinking of, like, two giant screens. You know, it reminds me of a certain semi-useless feature on MacBook Pros, but bigger and more useful. Yet, I don't know how to describe it. If you're not watching the video, you know, go over to PC World and search for HPS Omen X2S 15. But it's interesting because you can kind of zoom in on the display using it. It's a keyboard with a touchpad to the right of the keyboard. And then above the keyboard on the lower half of the laptop, there is an actual sort of embedded display. You know, it looks like a 4 or 6 inch embedded display. Then there's a, you know, then above the hinge, there's a full size 15 inch display. So, you know, you could, you know, it's a 6 inch screen, pardon me. And, you know, they have a utility built into it that allows you to do things like, you know, mirror parts of the screen or zoom in on a portion of the game on that smaller display. It's really interesting. You know, because it's a little 6-inch 1080p LCD, and you know what's kind of slick is you know, you can hit a button and whatever's on the main display will go to the smaller display. The main display, by the way, is a 240Hz G-Sync panel, a 1080p G-Sync panel. So it's this is a fairly hefty gaming machine. You know, you had me at 240Hz.
Look at that cooling. If you're watching the video, just huge heat pipes and big fans on the bottom. What I was going to say is, like, I initially thought, oh, this is going to be like a, you know, some Android powered thing, or essentially like putting a smartphone into a laptop with some apps. But it Windows sees it as a secondary display, so you can really do whatever you want with it. You can use their utilities, as you mentioned, or you can mirror your display if you really feel like looking down at a 6-inch display instead of a G-Sync panel. But you can do anything you want. You could drag an app down into that window on your second display and, you know, watch videos or have any sort of application going in addition to what you have on your main screen, which, you know, I can see the implications for gaming if you're doing things like zooming in on like your target or something. But, or like in the picture, they show a map, which is cool. They don't have to have it, you know, taking space up on your screen. They're enlarging the map on the lower display by just zooming in. But it's just an interesting concept. And then, of course, the laptop itself is, you know, sort of monstrous in spec. It's
this is
Core
your classic.
I9. And,
yeah. I mean, the, you know, they expect the Omen X2S to start at like $2,100, but that will not be with a Core i9 processor and an RTX 2080 Max-Q GPU. I would not be shocked if this laptop, as tested, was much, much closer to like $3,000.
Or more.
77 watt hour battery, so they're trying to give you like 5 hours of battery life. And you know, Mr. Ng points out that because of the way G-Sync works, you have to have the GPU running at all times. Well, you know, why don't I just quote him directly? You know, it's like a 77 watt hour battery. You know, they're claiming about 5 hours of use. Quote, the blame mostly lies with G-Sync. NVIDIA's G-Sync requires the laptop GPU to be connected to the display, which means the graphics card will always be running. That just murders battery life. But a 77 watt hour battery is A, massive, and B, kind of a noble effort on HP's part to at least give you, you know, some, you know, I mean, I remember when 5 hours was pretty awesome battery performance for a laptop. So on the one hand, like, wow. On the other hand, you know, when you're looking at 15 hours of battery life, you know, off of an office laptop, it's somewhat underwhelming. Anyhow, pretty slick though.
Yeah. Pretty I wonder what's slick. The like battery or the AC adapter looks like. Just probably a massive
size of a house.
Brick like, yeah. It's the size of an ATX power supply.
Well, I had a 320 watt power supply over here until yesterday. So, you know, that thing measures, you know, would just about cover my face. You know, you'd see some ears on either side of it and not much else. Shannon bought, actually, Shannon's part of the, she bought one. And then right about the time Shannon bought one, Google's influencer group sent her a Google Pixel 3a. So she had like, was two-fisting Google Pixel 3As last week, earlier this week. Yeah, so she's a huge fan of the Google Pixel. She has a Google Pixel 3, and she went out and did side-by-side tests of the Google Pixel 3 and 3A. And there are features that are missing from the 3A because, hey, it's a $400 phone and not an $800 or $1,200 phone. But the camera is pretty much almost all of the camera you would expect from the Google Pixel, but you know, for hundreds of dollars less. Battery life solid so far. The headphone jack, particularly delightful. Yeah, there's, you know, the screen, you know, there's bezels on either side of the screen. It's made out of polycarbonate. It's funny because, yes, it is fancy plastic, but A, because I drop things, I like polycarbonate better than glass, and B, it had some heft to it, and it felt really good in the hand. So it did not feel cheap by any stretch of the imagination. But Pixel 3a is looking like a really good option in that sort of under $500 category. And the camera in it is vastly better than, say, what you were going to get in a $300 phone, $250 or $300 phone, like the my long-suffering G6, Motorola G6. So just wanted to give a quick heads up on that. She did a pretty in-depth review on Tech Thing this week. So if you want to hear all of the information on that phone, from the speaker quality to the camera quality to all the other things, head on over to Tech Thing for that one. Another update from last week, Google did a giant blog entry this morning. You know, and it basically comes down to, we hear you, updates to works with Nest. You know, last week we announced that we would stop supporting the Works with Nest program on August 31st. And this week, they've decided that your existing, I'm going to quote here, your existing devices and integrations will continue working with your Nest account. However, you won't have access to new features that will be available with a Google account because they want you to move to a Google account. You know, they plan on delivering, they want to move everybody to Google Assistant. You know, works with Google Assistant, works with 3,500 partners, 30,000 devices, works with Assistant routines. You know, they are going to bring the automatic trigger of home and away status to the Google Assistant later this year. You know, essentially they've acknowledged that you know, people spent years integrating their home and lifestyle in with Works with Nest, and you know, connections will continue to work. They won't get killed off on August 31st. Quote, not until replaced in Works with Assistant. So short answer is they're not going to kill it off August 31st. Long answer, they're going to kill it off as fast as they can develop it or develop replacements inside of Works with Assistant. So that was, it was interesting. It was interesting watching the response on that because, you know, it took me a while to really kind of grok the idea that they were really aiming to kill off Works with Nest. And it was also interesting to watch the responses on Twitter, which I won't get into at the moment. Did you read Samsung's claims that they're moving to 3-nanometer chips?
Yeah, I was just looking
at this. Or I should say a 3-nanometer process.
3-nanometer process, which is funny because, you know, AMD is very proud of TSMC's 7-nanometer and that they're using in all their products, and Intel is still struggling on their own process to get 10-nanometer out the door in volume. And here's Samsung saying, yeah, that's cute. We have 3-nanometer. It'll be ready by 2021. So, and, you know, it's half the power. They're saying up to 35% more speed. And it's, I was just looking at, like, what is the technology here? It's GAA, gates all around transistors, which you can read all about in this Cena article, so I need to educate myself here, but that's their own. I believe it's their own. Yeah, it's Samsung manufacturing, so yeah. Not TSMC. Or,
you know, yeah, it's very. Yeah, they're very excited, right? They're going to boost speed 35%. They're going to cut power use 50%. It's going to make your phone the coolest, bestest thing ever, and you know, they're basically. So, you know, they're quoting a consultant from International Business Strategies who says that Samsung is 12 months ahead of TSMC. and that Intel is 2 to 3 years behind Samsung, which means they're a year or two behind TSMC. Although, quite frankly, it feels like they're farther behind than TSMC than that. But of course, they because they were so far ahead for so long, and then things slowed down. I'm really curious to see if this actually happens. You know,
They're pretty enthusiastic. I'm looking and like, I'm sure there will be new technology beyond 1 nanometer.
Right.
This person is quoted as saying, like, I'm not sure what kind of structure, but it will emerge. So it's just never going to end, Patrick. We'll just have to come up with a new name. We went from micrometers to nanometers. And what's next? I'm sure there's some technical, you know, explanation that I don't know, but there's some term that I'm not aware of.
I'll be curious, like, how long it takes them to get, you know, to yields that they can afford to produce. Because they're talking about creating a 3D structure that wraps, you know, if I'm reading this right, that wraps the entire channel with gate material. So
it's like a hug.
Yeah. So, you know, this is interesting. You know, I'm also kind of curious to see where this goes. I also didn't realize that Qualcomm uses Samsung to build some of its Snapdragon 730 processors. I thought that was kind of interesting. So we shall see. Yeah. GAA. It's the future. Gate all around transistors will change everything. You know, the other one that was interesting this week from the phone universe was 9to5 Mac. Right, so Intel, Apple, 5G modems, mayhem, crisis. And the headline on this one from Michael Pollack over at 9to5 Mac is Apple's custom 5G modems may not arrive until 2025 after a, quote, long and painful divorce, end quote, with Intel. You know, and this is kind of referring to an article from theinformation.com that is writing, you know, that is titled Behind the Intel Apple Modem Divorce. And you have to subscribe to get full access to that article.
You know, the snippet here reads almost like a voiceover narration in a noir movie or something.
Yeah.
And just imagine a dark street.
Apple's preparing a line of iPhones. So
it's kind of similar to what I had read from Semi-Accurate when they were talking about how the issue began with Apple basically saying, here's the roadmap, and Intel saying we're not ready, or, well, here it is, but it doesn't work properly yet. And just whatever really happened, Apple apparently being fed up enough or deciding it was in their best interest to move on. And Intel immediately just exiting the 5G business entirely. So
yeah. The other thing that came out of this is, like, so the modem situation kind of blew up. Apple's probably trying to figure out, you know, it sounds like Apple's going to, you know, has relaunched their in-house modem design. You know, whether or not they can get parts from Qualcomm. And the other thing that the 9to5 Mac says that Tim Cook called out Intel's chip availability in their last earning calls that where did it go? Well, you know, when it comes down to it is that they couldn't get enough chips to sell enough Macs, and that it impacted earnings. So you know, that might explain why Apple seems to be on such a push to use their own in-house processors on something beyond the iPhone and iPads and et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's interesting. I'm really kind of curious. You know, 2025 seems really late.
Do you think?
For 5G integration, but it also, I mean, the thing is, though, it's like the title, you know, the title's kind of misleading because it's like Apple's custom 5G modem. So in the meantime,
I mean, they'll be, you know, buying from Qualcomm until then. Yeah, yes. So, begrudgingly, yeah,
But they will. You got hands on with Be Quiet's Darkbase 900. I was also laughing because you had a link to a $999 case, and for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why that case was $1,000. But
where's my link? It's gone. Oh well,
I don't know. We'll find it.
Okay,
I'll find it. You talk about the Be Quiet Darkbase 900.
Well, it's the top of the line from Be Quiet, and they have a number of cases kind of hitting different price targets. The 700, the Darkbase 700, was the last one we looked at here, and that was their limited edition in white, and it comes in a standard black. This is the full tower, so the top of the line. This thing retails at $269, and looking it over, just initial exterior impressions, it's got an aluminum skin. It's not all aluminum. It has an aluminum skin over like the top and front panels, and looks very sharp. The front door opens with like spring closures, and inside you have your typical like enclosed fan intake where you're drawing air from this sort of mesh that's around the perimeter of the top and front panels. And inside, not only do you have fan intakes, but you have two 5 1/4 bays, which is very unusual for a case these days. So if you still, you know, like to use optical drives, this is one of the cases that can be on your list now of like, you know, multi DVD-ROM or DVD-RW Blu-ray drives will fit in this thing. Previously, I think that it's been just a single optical bay that I find in just a case here and there, and this one actually has two. The Fractal Design Define R6, if I'm getting the number right, has one. The R5, I think, had two, but they've dropped one of them. So it's just interesting things. It has a wireless charger for your phone built into the top of the case, which the original Darkbase 900 had as well. This is the Revision 2. It came out last year, I believe, and it basically updated I/O, so it has the faster like Gen 2 USB 3.1 Type-C port on the top. It has a fast charging USB port for a phone, plus that wireless charging pad. And kind of some interesting touches to the way that this case is constructed. The bottom shroud. A lot of cases we see with PSU shrouds on the bottom, on the inside. And this one is kind of modular. You can take it out, and you actually have to take it out to build the case because the PSU mounts underneath it, which is kind of unusual. Just some things that it takes a little bit of extra time to build this case, but when you look at the rather massive accessory pack it comes with all these extra parts for mounting liquid cooling and additional cooling and extra SSDs, and comes with three extra hard drive cages. And so it's pretty deluxe. So I started to kind of come down a little bit when I initially, my sticker shock at the $269. And of course, it's funny that you mentioned at the outset this $1,000 case that Inwin announced that's available now. But, you know, $269 is a lot for a case. And then, of course, Inwin's 928 Super Tower, which you found.
Or so you thought.
Like, oh, well, $999. Well, I expect that Inwin always has, like, these, like, just absolutely beautiful, but very, very expensive kind of, I guess I'll use the word aspirational computer cases that look unbelievable in their CES booth, like the motorized case, the H-frame, I think, and they have just some wonderful all-aluminum designs that are just staggeringly expensive. But here I am complaining about a mere $269. It seems like every case I touch has to be at least $200. It's like another week, another $200 case. How much is this one? Oh, $199. That figures. But back to the Darkbase 900 version 2, revision 2. It's very quiet. It's a Be Quiet case. They started as a company that made those panels that went inside of computer cases to make them quieter. And they have those inside of every, you know, panel on this except for the glass side, of course.
Right.
So there's a bit of a concession there to make it look pretty and to see your build. And this comes with RGB lighting, which you don't have to use. They're separate lighting strips that you put wherever you want. But it's all very, very, very well put together, very impressively built, as always. I've reviewed, I think, three of their cases so far, and they always have extremely like everything is lined up really well. Everything is machined well. I never have any issues with, with the build process at all. This one's just a little bit more complex. I actually had to use the manual, which, you know, who reads the manual? But of course, you should always read the manual when you're building a computer case. But I had to. I'm like, what? How do I put the PSU in here? What's going on? This, where does that screw go? So it all went together. It looks fine. Yeah. And a surprising amount of airflow. It doesn't really show up in pictures. You look at a solid door with a big panel on the inside of it to reduce noise, and you're thinking this thing is going to be like a little oven. But it moves quite a bit of air. It comes with 340 millimeter fans, and temperatures were not going to be, you know, as good as they would be in an airflow case with a mesh front panel, but they were perfectly fine, and it was very quiet. I mean, my highest noise level recorded was under 34 decibels. It was like 33 point something. So very, very quiet. And then you do have the option of tweaking the fan controller. They use this interesting dual zone fan controller on their higher end cases that has, I think, four fans on each channel. So you can have, I think, 8 or maybe it's 10 connected to it. And you can choose. There's a little switch on the controller itself for each channel. You can say, well, this is the performance side and that's the quiet side, or leave them both at performance or quiet. And I left them at quiet. And then in addition to that, there's this stepless fan speed controller above those optical bays. And you can just slide it to the left and right to, like, on the fly, change your fan speeds and even further fine tune them beyond that switch. So a very good level of control just to hit whatever kind of thermal and especially noise target you're trying to reach with the case. And, you know, if you've got 200 plus to spend on a case, you start looking at things like, well, how quiet is it? You know, obviously, do you like the aesthetics? Does it have the room you need? And then this enters into the equation of, does it have optical drive support, which, you know, you're not going to find a lot of cases with two of them. So I've talked about it enough. You can read the review if you want to see more. I think I took like 40 or 50 pictures in this one, just galleries of images galore.
So you mentioned when doing aspirational cases, you know, these beautiful cases at CES. I'm trying to figure out, because I keep looking over at this picture, like, the 928's armored shell is composed of anodized 4 millimeter thick aluminum, which offers a clear view, or equipped with tempered glass side panels, clear view, innards, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just trying to figure out how this thing, I mean, it's got a lot of fans, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Don't tell me you're trying to figure out why it's $1,000.
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm trying to do.
Well, you know, Patrick, it's because it's just a higher echelon of enclosure. It takes you to a different place that you've never been to before.
Oh.
You can ride down the road in a beat up old it's a Kia from, you know, 1999. Or so Hugo. I don't know, Hugos have a certain sort of cachet, or maybe it's just
anytime you have the spare tire.
Driving Mona like 10 times.
You know, this when you can use this, when the spare tire is literally the part of the cover for the air filter, you've got a certain level of creativity that is admirable in a vehicle, but it's also a vehicle that's kind of universally mocked. I mean, it's interesting to look at the design on this, because there's a lot going on in terms of the structure and the frame on this. But yeah, I this may be one of those things like $10,000 speaker cables where it primarily exists because there is a category of consumer that will buy the most expensive thing available. Also, you'd think for a product that they're trying to get people excited about, they might put a few more pictures on the website.
Yeah. We'll have to wait for the first video reviews to hit YouTube, I'm sure.
Oh, my goodness.
But it is out of stock. I can't order one if I wanted to. I'm sorry. I can't be the guinea pig and order one of these.
You know, I think,
but only because it's out of stock.
Yes. Well, apparently, it hasn't actually gone up for sale yet. So perhaps they are gauging demand for it at the $999 price point. SanDisk, speaking of expensive things that are shiny and make me happy, well, unlike the Inwin, SanDisk is finally selling the 1 terabyte micro SD cards we heard about earlier this year. And I was laughing because it's completely sold out on Amazon.com. But, you know, $450 on SanDisk. And I was laughing because perhaps it's my connection to SanDisk's website, either that or SanDisk's website is okay. That's the Amazon page. Click on the SanDisk link for everybody watching on the video at home. And okay, so in my case, all I'm getting is a giant text filled page, and I'm like, I can't believe this page is getting hammered that hard. But $450 direct from SanDisk, you know, as somebody that has a 400 gigabytes SanDisk card in their phone, I got to say, I was really stoked to see the 1 terabyte cards come out. I will also admit that I have not filled up the 400 gigabyte card. You know, and if you are looking for all of the music to be stored locally on your system, like 400 gigabyte cards are selling for $90 now, 512 gigabyte cards for $200, 1 terabyte cards for $450. Not the highest performance, although I'll be honest with you, you know, you're looking at V30. A lot of people are like, I need V60 or V90, which I guess is because they're recording 4K video on their phones. But, you know, it's U3A2 V30. So you're looking at like 30 megabytes per second, which is enough to do 1080p video. And if you're playing back video or audio, which is what I would be doing with a card this size in a phone, you have more than enough storage or more than enough speed to play stuff back. But anytime storage makes a big jump, I'm excited.
Where are the 2 terabyte cards? Come on.
They'll be here eventually.
I need to record 8K HDR video on my phone.
I understand the theory behind that. I will say, having played around with, you know, I've got 3 SanDisk Extreme Pro SD cards that I've been playing around with, and I have to start recording again and labeling them because one of these cards will not successfully record for more than a few minutes because it seems to have heat issues. The other two do just fine, and I would be really nervous about recording 8K video on a micro SD card unless there was some pretty serious cooling inside of my device I was recording with. I got to add one more thing in here because we talk a lot about ALEXA and our friend at Google that we can talk to and make things turn on and off inside of the house. The Ronnie Mola over at Vox did a nice write-up on this. So this is based on a survey, and the survey is the Internet Society working along with Consumers International, and 63% of people find connected devices creepy. 75% of people distrust the way data is shared, you know, but they still keep buying stuff. You know, and it's one of my favorite headlines in a long time. People say that they care about privacy, but they continue to buy devices that can spy on them.
Of course. It's like, I care about privacy, but this fridge, it reads my thoughts and orders milk for me. Okay.
It's not the hugest survey, but it's, you know, it's statistically significant. They called like a minimum of 1,000 people in the United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, France, the United Kingdom. 70% of the people they contacted said they own, quote, one or more connected devices, which include smart appliances, fitness monitors, gaming consoles. And this was also, as the author points out, they had a very broad definition of connected devices. You know, pretty much anything that connected to the internet using Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, include things like, quote, Amazon's Echo speakers, Google's Nest smart lock, Furbo's pet camera treat dispenser, but did not include mobile phones, tablets, or computers. And what's crazy is, you know, smart devices in the sort of larger sense, you know, they point out that the sales were up 25% last year. They expect double-digit growth to continue for the next few years. And that's despite the fact that most people think these are weird and have deep concerns over what happens to their data. It's just, you know.
They can't have it both ways.
But they do.
But they do, that's right. Well, they think they do.
They think they do. Well, you know, quote, people who say they're concerned with security will do a lot of very insecure things. Robert W. Proctor, a professor at Purdue University's Department of Psychological Sciences, said it doesn't match up very well. So, you know, I just thought that was amusing. I also might be easy to amuse at this point. But, you know, and this is also on top of the fact that, you know, the more testing goes on with a lot of connected devices, the more security flaws are found in them. And most of them, especially if they're inexpensive, are relatively, well, they're just simply not going to be fixed in most cases by the device manufacturer. So something to think about while you're contemplating the future of your connected home. And wondering whether or not the service you're investing in will still be available to connect it. Pound.
That's the key. Yes.
Google heard you.
I'm also in my own service. Like, I need to host my own service, but then, you know,
there's some pretty slick open source tools for that. But that is a conversation for another episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, because we have to wrap this week of This Week in Computer Hardware up. This week in computer hardware. I'm not going to try to say that again because I'll probably fall flat on my face. I'm Patrick Norton, ladies and gentlemen. You can find me over at techthing.com or avxl.com. One's a video. I answer questions and review products on one, and talk with Robert Herron about home theater, stereo, and audio equipment on the other one. And hint, one's Tech Thing, the other one's AVXL. And I've been talking to, you've been listening to the lovely Sebastian Peake, who is responsible for all of the content at PCPer.com. Not generating it, but making sure it's
not
awesome.
Not all of it, but yes. I am responsible in general. So I'm the one who gets yelled at, is basically what I'm trying to say.
He is one of the adults at PCPer.com. And you should head over to that website if you haven't, because the reviews are awesome. And the new website layout is gorgeous. Please, send them an email. They worked hard on that website. And in case it wasn't clear, you've been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. We like to call it Twitch, and you can find all the older episodes and information on how to subscribe at twitch.tv/TWICH. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. And if you want to ask us a question, best thing to do is tweet at Patrick Norton or at Sebastian Peake, because that's the easiest way to find us on the internet. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I am Sebastian Peake.
Catch you next week on Twitch.